the infamous door. Plus, they've opened the two walled-off upstairs doors. We decide to cancel the opening of the other large door that would join the living room to the contadina kitchen. The image of all Benito's men fleeing the premises does not inspire confidence. The next delays Ian mentions concern the new bath and the central heating. Almost certainly, he advises, there will be no heat when you come for Christmas. In fact, the house will not be habitable due to the fact that the central heating pipes must be inside the house, not on the back, as we originally were told. Benito asks him to relay that his charges are higher than anticipated. Items listed on the contract have been farmed out to electricians and plumbers, and their overlapping bills have become incomprehensible. We have no way of knowing who did what. Ian seems as confused as we are. Money we wired over takes too long to get there, and Benito is angry. What is clear is that we are not there, and our house's work is done between other jobs. Hoping for miracles, we go to Italy for Christmas. Elizabeth has offered us her house in Cortona, which is partly packed for her move. She also wants to give us a great deal of her furniture, since her new house is smaller. As we drive out of the Rome airport, rain hits the windshield like a hose turned on full blast. All the way north, we face foggier and foggier weather. When we arrive in Camuccia, we head straight to the bar for hot chocolate before we go to Elizabeth's. We decide to unpack, have lunch, and face Bramasole later. The house is a wreck. Canals for the heating pipes have been cut into the inside walls of every room in the house. The workers have left rock and rubble in piles all over the unprotected floors. The plastic we had requested was simply tossed over the furniture, so every book, chair, dish, bed, towel, and receipt in the house is covered in dirt. The jagged, deep floor-to-ceiling cuts in the wall look like open wounds. They are just beginning on the new bathroom, laying cement on the floor. The plaster in the new kitchen already is cracking. The great long sink has been installed and looks wonderful. A workman has scrawled in black felt-tip pen a telephone number on the dining room fresco. Ed immediately wets a rag and tries to rub it clean, but we're stuck with the plumber's number. He slings the rag onto the rubble. They've left windows open all over and puddles have collected on the floor from this morning's rain. The carelessness apparent everywhere, such as the telephone being completely buried, makes me so angry I have to walk outside and take gulps of cold air. Benito is at another job. One of his men sees that we're extremely upset and tries to say that all will be done soon and done well. He is working on the opening between the new kitchen and the cantina. He's shy but seems concerned. A beautiful house, beautiful position, all will be well. His bleary old blue eyes look at us sadly. Benito arrives, full of bluster. No time to clean up before we arrived. And anyway, it's the plumber's responsibility. Benito has been held up himself because the plumber didn't come when he said he would. But everything is perfetto, signori. He'll take care of the cracked plaster. It didn't dry properly because of the rains. We hardly answer. As he gestures, I catch the worker looking at me. Behind Benito's back, he makes a strange gesture. He nods toward Benito, then pulls down his eyelid. The upstairs patio seems perfect. They've laid rose-colored brick and reattached the rusty iron railing so that the patio is secure but still looks old. Something was done well. By 4, twilight begins. By 5, it's night. Still, the stores are opening after siesta. A morning of work, siesta, reopening at dark for several hours. The winter rhythm, unchanged from the massively hot summer days. We stop by and greet Signor Martini. We're cheered to see him, knowing he'll say "boh" and "anche troppo," one of his all-purpose responses that means, "yes, it's too bloody much." In our bad Italian, we explain what's going on. As we start to go, I remember the strange gesture. What does this mean? I ask, pulling down my eyelid. Forbo. Cunning. Watch out, he answers. Who's Forbo? He asks. Apparently our contractor. Warm house. Thank you, Elizabeth. We buy red candles, cut pine boughs, and bring them in for some semblance of Christmas. Our hearts are not into cooking, although all the winter ingredients in the shops almost lure us to the kitchen. We love the furniture Elizabeth has given us. Besides twin beds, coffee table, two desks, and lamps, we'll have an antique matia whose top part was used to knead bread and let it rise. On the list she's left for us, we find her immense armadio, large enough to hold all the house linens. We find a dining room table, antique chest, a tall storage chest, two peasant chairs, and wonderful plates and serving pieces. Suddenly, we will live in a furnished house. With all our rooms, there will be plenty of space still for acquiring our own treasures. Amid all the restoration horrors, this great act of generosity warms us tremendously. Right now, the pieces seem to belong to her orderly house, but before we leave, we must move everything over to the house full of debris. As Christmas nears, work slows, then stops. We had not anticipated that they would take off so many holidays. New Year's has several holidays attached to it. We never heard of San Stefano, who merits one day off. Francesco Falco, who's worked for Elizabeth for 20 years, brings his son Giorgio and his son-in-law with a truck. They take apart the armadio, load everything onto the truck. At the house, we cram all the furniture into two rooms we've shoveled out and swept. We cover everything with plastic and shut the doors. There is absolutely nothing we can do. Benito does not answer our calls. I have a sore throat. We've bought no presents. Ed has grown silent. My daughter, sick with flu in New York, is spending her first Christmas alone because the construction debacle threw off her plans to come to Italy. I stare for a long time at an ad for the Bahamas in a magazine, the totally expected photo of a crescent of sugar sand beach along clear azure waters. Someone, somewhere, drifts on a yellow-striped float, trailing her fingers in a warm current and dreaming under the sun. On Christmas Eve, we have pasta with wild mushrooms, veal, and excellent Chianti. Only one other person is in the restaurant, for Natale is above all a family time. He wears a brown suit and sits very straight. I see him slowly drink wine along with his food, pouring out half glasses for himself, sniffing the wine as though it were a great vintage instead of the house carafe. He proceeds through his courses with care. We're through. It's only 9:30. We'll go back to Elizabeth's, build a fire, and share the Moscato dessert wine and cake I bought this afternoon. While Ed waits for coffee, our dinner partner is served a plate of cheese and a bowl of walnuts. The restaurant is silent. He cracks a shell. He cuts a bit of cheese, savors it, eats a walnut, then cracks another. I want to put my head down on the white cloth and weep. According to Ian, the work finished satisfactorily at the end of February. We paid for the amount contracted, but not for the exorbitant extra amount Benito tacked on. He listed such charges as $1,000 for hanging a door. In late April, Ed returns to Italy. He has the spring quarter off. His plan is to clear the land and treat, stain, and wax all the beams in the house before I arrive on June 1st. Then we will clean, paint all the rooms and windows, and restore the floors to the condition they were in before Benito's restoration. The new kitchen has in it only the sink, dishwasher, stove, and fridge. Instead of cabinets, we plan to make plastered brick columns with wide plank shelves and have marble cut for the countertops. We have a major incentive. At the end of June, My friend Susan has planned to be married in Cortona. When I asked why she wanted her wedding in Italy, she replied cryptically, "I want to get married in a language I don't understand." The guests will stay with us, and the wedding will take place at the 12th century town hall. Ed tells me he's confined to the room on the second floor that opens onto the patio, his little haven amid the rubbish. He cleans one bathroom, unpacks a few pots and dishes, and sets up rudimentary housekeeping. He relates that each room takes 40 hours, beams, ceilings, walls. Floors will come last, 7 to 7, 7 days a week. Finally, finally, June, I can go. With all the work Ed has described, I expect the house to glow when I arrive. But naturally enough, Ed has concentrated on telling me his progress. When I first arrive, it's hard to focus on how far he has come. The beams look beautiful, yes, but the grounds are full of rubbish, plaster, and the old cistern. The electrician has not shown up. 6 rooms haven't been touched. All the furniture is piled into 3 rooms. It's strictly a war zone. I try not to show how horrified I am. I'm ready for R&R. Unfortunate, because there's nothing to do but launch into this work. We have about 3 weeks to get ready for our first major onslaught of guests. The wedding. It seems ludicrous that anyone could stay here. Ed is 6'2", I am 5'4". He takes the ceiling, I take the floor. Biology is destiny. But which is better? He actually loves finishing the beams. Painting the brick ceiling is less fun, but is rewarding. Suddenly, the gunky beams and flaking ceiling are transformed into dark, substantial beams, pristine white brick ceiling. The room is defined. Painting goes quickly with the big brushes made of wild boar hair. Pure white walls. White on plaster is whiter than any other white. As each room is finished, my job is to paint the batoscopo, a 6-inch-high gray strip along the bases of the walls, a kind of pseudo-molding that is traditional in old houses of this area. Usually it's a brick color, but we prefer the lighter touch. The word means broom hit. The darker paint doesn't show the marks of the brooms and mops that must constantly pass over these floors. Almost upside down, I measure 6 inches in several places, tape the floor and wall, then quickly paint and pull off the tape. Naturally, the tape pulls off some white paint, which then has to be retouched. 12 rooms, 4 walls each, plus the stairwell, landing, and entrance. We're leaving the stone cantina as is. Next, I decalcify the floor. The first step is to sweep up all the large chunks and dirt, then vacuum. With a special solution I spread, the residue from dirt, plaster, and paint drippings is dissolved. After that, I rinse the floor with a wet mop 3 times, the middle time with a mild soap solution. I'm on my knees. Next, mop again with water and a little muriatic acid. Rinse, then paint the floor with linseed oil, letting it soak in and dry. After it dries for 2 days, I wax. On the floor again, char style. My knees, totally unused to this, rebel, and I suppress groans when I stand up. Last step, buff with soft cloth. The floors come back, rich and dark and shiny. From high school through graduate school, Ed worked as a house mover, busboy, cabinet maker, refrigerator hauler. A friend calls him the muscular poet. He's thriving on this work, though he too is sapped at night. I never have done manual labor except spurts of refinishing furniture, pruning, painting, and wallpapering. This is an order of bodily exertion to shock my system. Everything aches. I die at night. In the mornings, we both have surges of new energy that come from somewhere. We plug right back in. We're consumed. I'm amazed the relentlessness we've developed. I never will feel the same toward workers again. They should be paid fortunes. After we clean up late in the day, we walk around assessing what's left. How we've done. We will not have any children together, but decide that this is the equivalent of having triplets. As each room is finished, we get to bring in the furniture for it. Gradually, rooms are set up, still spare but basically furnished. I've brought over white bedspreads for the twin beds. We take a morning in Arezzo and buy a few lamps from a place that still makes the traditional majolica vases of the area into lamps. A fabulous feeling. Things are shaping up. They're done. It's clean. We'll be warm in winter. We've done it. This feels giddy and fuels us to keep going. A week before the wedding, our friends Shura and Kevin arrive from California. We keep working while they go to Florence, Assisi, and on the Piero della Francesca trail. At night we make great meals together, and they tell us all the wonders they've seen, and we tell them about the new faucet we want to install for the hip bath. They fall instantly in love with the whole area and seem to want to hear our daily saga of cleaning the new bricks on the kitchen floor. When they're not traveling, Kevin is off on long bicycle trips. Shira, an artist, is captive here. She is painting milky blue half circles over the windows in her bedroom. We've picked a star from one of Giotto's paintings, and she makes a stencil of it and fills the half domes with gold leaf stars. A few stars fall out of the dome and onto the white walls. We're preparing the bridal chamber. At an antique shop near Perugia, I buy two colored prints of the constellations, with mythological beasts and figures. At the Cortona market, I find pretty linen and cotton sheets, in pale blue with cutwork and white. We're preparing, too, for our first house party. We buy 20 wine glasses, linen tablecloths, pans for baking the wedding cake, a case of wine. There is no way everything can be finished in time for the wedding, but we manage an extraordinary amount. The day before everyone arrives, Kevin comes downstairs and asks, "Why does the toilet steam? Is there something peculiar about Italian toilets?" Ed brings in the ladder, climbs up to the wall-mounted tank, and dips in his hand. Hot water. We check the other bathrooms. The new one is okay, but the other old one also has hot water. We hardly have used those bathrooms and had not let the water run long enough for the hot water to arrive. So we had not noticed that neither bathroom had cold water at all. As soon as guests started using the baths, it became noticeable. Shira says she thought the shower was awfully hot once it finally warmed up, but hadn't wanted to complain. The plumber cannot come for a few days, so we will go through the wedding with quick showers and smoking toilets. The front terrace is still rough, but we have potted geraniums along the wall to distract from the torn-up ground. At least we've removed the rubble. Four rooms have beds. Susan's two cousins from England and Cole's brother and sister-in-law are arriving. Shira and Kevin will move to a hotel for a couple of days. Other friends are coming from Vermont. By day, we are 12 in the house. Many hands to help with drinks and lunch. The cake must be improvised because the oven is small. I envision three tiers of sponge cake with a hazelnut buttercream frosting to be served with whipped cream and cherries steeped in sugared wine. We couldn't find a large pan for the bottom and finally bought a tin dog dish to bake it in. The cake is lovely, if a bit lopsided. We decorate it with flowers all around. Everyone is running off in different directions, sightseeing and shopping. We're having the prenuptial dinner here on a clear, warm night. Everyone in pale linens and cottons. Many photos are taken of us, arm in arm on the steps and leaning over the balcony. Susan's cousin brings out champagne he has brought from France. After drinks with bruschette and dry olives, we start with cool fennel soup. I've made a rustic casserole of chicken, white beans, sausage, tomatoes, and onions. There are tiny green beans, baskets of bread, and a salad of arugula, radicchio, and chicory. Everyone tells wedding stories. Mark was to have married a Colorado girl who ran away on the wedding day and married someone else in a week. Karen was a bridesmaid on a boat wedding, and the bride's mother in teal chiffon tipped into the drink. When I married at 22, I wanted a midnight wedding with everyone wearing robes and carrying candles. The minister said absolutely not, that midnight was a furtive hour. 9 was as late as he'd go. And instead of a robe, I wore my sister's wedding dress and carried a leather-bound Keats down the aisle. My mother pulled my skirt, and I leaned over for her words of wisdom. She whispered, "It won't last 6 months." But she was wrong. "We should have an accordion player a la Fellini, and maybe a white horse for the bride to ride. But we do well with the fabulous night, and the CD player inspires a little dancing in the dining room. The white peach tart with pine nuts should end this dinner, but Ed's description of the hazelnut gelato in town sends everyone to the cars. They're amazed that such a small town is still hopping at 11, everyone outdoors with coffee, ice cream, or perhaps an amaro, an after-dinner bitter. Babies in strollers still as wide-eyed as their parents, teenagers sitting on the town hall steps. The only thing sleeping is a cat on top of the police car. The morning of the wedding, Susan Shearer and I pick a bouquet of lavender, pink and yellow wildflowers for Susan to carry. When we're all dressed in silks and suits, we walk into town over the Roman road. Ed carries our good shoes in a shopping bag. Susan has brought Chinese painted paper parasols for everyone because of the midday sun. We walk through town and up the steps of the 12th century town hall. It's a dark, high-ceilinged room with tapestries and frescoes and high, judicial-looking chairs, an impressive room to sign a treaty in. The city of Cortona has sent red roses, and Ed has arranged for Bar Sport to come right over after the ceremony with cold Prosecco. Susan's cousin Brian runs all around with his video camera, getting shots from every angle. After the brief ceremony, we cross the piazza to La Loggetta for a Tuscan feast beginning with a selection of typical antipasti, crostini, little rounds of bread topped with olives, peppers, mushroom, or chicken liver, prosciutto e melone, fried olives stuffed with pancetta and spicy breadcrumbs, and the local finocchiona, a salami studded with fennel seeds. Next, they bring out a selection of primi, first courses to try, including ravioli with butter and sage, and gnocchi di patate, little knuckles of potatoes served here with pesto. Course after course arrives, culminating in platters of roast lamb and veal and the famous grilled Valdichiana steak. Karen notices the grand piano in the corner under a massive vase of flowers and prevails upon Cole, who is a pianist, to play. Ed is at the other end of the table, but he catches my eye as Cole begins Scarlatti. 3 weeks ago, this was a dream, a long shot, a frightening prospect. Cheers, the English cousins call out. Back at home, we're all stunned by the food and heat and decide to postpone the wedding cake until late afternoon. I hear someone snoring. In fact, I hear two people snoring. Though the cake lacks that professional touch, it may be the best cake I ever tasted. Shira and Kevin are dancing in the dining room again. Others stroll out to the point where our land ends for the view of the lake and valley. We can't decide whether to eat again or forget it. Finally, we run down to Camuccia for pizza. Our favorite places are closed, so we end up in a definitely downscale, unatmospheric place. The pizza is excellent, however, and no one seems to notice the dust-gray curtains or the cat who has leapt on the adjoining table and is polishing off the remains of someone's dinner. At the end of the table, our bride and groom, holding hands, are in a charmed circle of two. Susan and Cole have headed to Lucca, then back to France. Their family guests are gone. Shira and Kevin are here for a few more days. Ed and I visit the Marmista and choose thick white marble for the countertops. The next day he cuts and bevels them, and Ed and Kevin load them into the back of the car. Suddenly the kitchen looks the way I thought it would. Brick floor, white appliances, long sink, plank shelves, marble counters. I sew a blue plaid curtain to go under the sink and hang a braid of garlic and some dried herbs from the wall shelves. In town, we find an old peasant dish and cup rack. The dark chestnut looks great against the white walls. At last, a place for all the cups and bowls we're buying in the local ceramic patterns. Everyone has gone. We eat the last of the wedding cake. Ed begins one of his many lists. We should paper a room with them, of projects he hopes to accomplish now. The kitchen is looking irresistible, and we're moving into high season for vegetables and fruit. July 4th. Much of the summer is left. My daughter is coming. Traveling friends will stop in for lunch or for a night. We're ready. A long table under the trees. Market day falls on Thursdays in Kemuchea, the lively town at the bottom of Cortona's Hill, and I'm there early before the heat sets in. Tourists pass right through Kemuchea. It's just the modern spillover from the venerable and dominant hill town above it. But modern is relative. Among the fruta e verdura shops, the hardware and seed stores, you happen on a couple of Etruscan tombs. Near the butcher's shop are remnants of a villa, an immense curly iron gate and a swag of garden wall. Kemuchea, bombed in World War II, has its share of chestnut trees, photographable doors, and shuttered houses. On market day, a couple of streets are blocked to traffic. The vendors arrive early, unfolding what seems like whole stores or supermarket aisles from specially made trucks and wagons. A friend says Italy is getting to be just like everywhere else, homogenized and Americanized, she says disparagingly. I want to drag her here and stand her in a doorway. The men have the look of their lives. Perhaps we all do. Hard work, their faces and bodies affirm. All are lean, not a pound of extra fat anywhere. They look cured by the sun, so deeply tanned they probably never go pale in winter. Their country clothes are serviceable, rough. They wear as well a natural dignity. Surely some are canny, crusty, cruel, but they look totally present, unhidden and alive. Some are missing teeth, but they smile widely without embarrassment. I look in one man's eyes. The left one is white, with milky blue veins like those in an exploded marble. The other is black as the center of a sunflower. A retarded boy wanders among them, neither catered to nor ignored. He's just there, living his life like the rest of us. My impulse is to overload. I forget there are not 10 hungry people at home. At first I was miffed when tomatoes or peas had spoiled when I got around to cooking them a few days later. Finally I caught on that what you buy today is ready, picked or dug this morning at its peak. This also explained another puzzle. I never understood why Italian refrigerators are so minute until I realized that they don't store food the way we do. The Sub-Zero Giant I have at home begins to seem almost institutional compared to the toy fridge I now have here. I could complete my shopping for this meal right here. I pass cages of guinea hens, ducks, and chickens as well as rabbits. Since my daughter had a black Angora rabbit as a pet once, I can't look with cold eyes on the two spotted bunnies nibbling carrots in the dusty Alitalia flight bag. Can't imagine them trembling in the trunk of my car. I have as much as I can carry. The other stop I'll make is at the cooperative cantina for some local wine. Near the end of the sinuous line of market stalls, a woman sells flowers from her garden. She wraps an armful of pink zinnias in newspaper, and I lay them under the straps of my bag. The sun is ferocious, and people are beginning to close down for siesta. On my way out, I see a man in a sweater, despite the heat. The trunk of his minuscule Fiat is piled with black grapes that have warmed all morning in the sun. I'm stopped by the winey, musty, violet scents. He offers me one. The hot sweetness breaks open in my mouth. I have never tasted anything so essential in my life as this grape on this morning. They even smell purple, the flavor older than the Etruscans, and deeply fresh and pleasing, just leaves me stunned. Such richness. The big globes. The heap of dusty grapes cascading out of two baskets. I asked for un grappolo, a bunch, wanting the taste to stay with me all morning. As I unload my cloth sacks, the kitchen fills with the scents of sunny fruits and vegetables. I'm still amazed that the kitchen is finished. Like those in the rest of the house, the floors are wax brick, the walls white plaster, and the ceiling has, oh, Ed's neck and back, dark beams. We avoided cabinets. It was easy to construct the plaster-covered brick supports, built for thick plank shelves we envisioned when we spent our evenings drawing on tablets of grid paper. Ed and I cut and painted them white. The baskets from the market hold utensils and staples. The 2-inch-thick white Carrara marble tops are smooth to my eye and always cool to the touch, or to pizza dough and pastry. We hung the same rough shelves on another wall for glasses and pasta bowls. To secure the brackets, Ed drilled toggle bolts into solid rock, spewing stones and straining the drill to its highest whine. The signora who lived here 100 years ago could walk in now and start to cook. She'd like the porcelain sink, big enough to bathe a baby in, its drain board and the curved chrome faucet. I imagine her with a pointed chin and shiny black eyes, her hair swept up and twisted in a comb. She's in sturdy shoes that tie and a black dress with the sleeves pushed up, ready to roll out the ravioli. She'd be ecstatic, no doubt, to see appliances, the dishwasher stove and frost-free fridge, still a novelty in Tuscany, but otherwise she'd feel quite at home. In my next life, when I am an architect, I always will design houses with kitchens that open to the outdoors. I love stepping out to head and tail my beans while sitting on the stone wall. I set dirty pots out to soak, dry my dishcloths on the wall, empty excess clean water on the arugula, thyme, and rosemary right outside the door. Since the double door is open day and night in summer, the kitchen fills with light and air. A wasp flies in every day and drinks from the faucet, then flies right out. The one absolutely American feature is the lighting. Terrifically high utility costs explain the prevalence of 40-watt bulbs hanging in so many houses. I cannot bear a dim kitchen. We chose 2 bright fixtures and a rheostat, causing Lino, the electrician, extreme consternation. He had never installed a rheostat, which intrigued him. But the lights! 1 is enough. You are not performing surgery in here, he insisted. He needed to warn us that our electric bill, he had no words, only the gesture of loosely shaking both hands in front of him and shaking his head at the same time. Clearly we are headed for ruin. We poured so much energy into the kitchen because a dominant gene in my family is the cooking gene. No matter what occasion, what crisis, the women I grew up among could flat out hold forth in the kitchen, from pressed chicken to steaming cauldrons of Brunswick stew. In summer, my mother and our cook Willie Bell went into marathons of putting up tomatoes, pickling cucumbers, stirring vats of scuppernongs for jelly. By early December, they had made brandied cakes and shelled mountains of pecans for roasting. Never was our kitchen without tins of brownies and icebox cookies, or without a plate of cold biscuits left over from dinner. I still miss toasted biscuits for breakfast. At one meal, we already were talking about the next. My daughter showed every sign of breaking the legacy of my mother and Willie, whose talents destined my sisters and me to shelves of cookbooks, constant plans for the next party, and ultimate test, even the fate to cook when eating alone. Throughout her childhood, except for an occasional batch of obsidian-like fudge, Ashley disdained the kitchen. Shortly after she graduated from college, she began to cook and immediately started calling home for recipes for chicken with 40 cloves of garlic, profiteroles, risotto, chocolate souffle, potatoes Anna. Without meaning to, she seemed to have absorbed certain knowledge. Now when we're together, we too go into paroxysms of planning and cooking. She has taught me a great marinated pork tenderloin recipe and a buttermilk lemon cake. These familial connections give me a helpless feeling. Cooking is destiny. This inexorable inheritance notwithstanding, in recent years I've worked more and more. In our normal life in San Francisco, everyday cooking becomes at times a chore. I confess to an occasional supper of ice cream from the carton, eaten with a fork while leaning against the kitchen counter. Sometimes we both get home late and find in the fridge celery, grapes, withered apples, and milk. No problem, since San Francisco has great restaurants. On weekends, we try to roast two chickens, or make minestrone, or a big pasta sauce to get us to Tuesday. On Wednesday, a stop at Gordo's for super carnitas burritos with sour cream, guacamole, extra hot sauce, and 1,000 grams of fat. The leisure of a summer place, the ease of prime ingredients, and the perfectly casual way of entertaining convince me that this is the kitchen as it's meant to be. I think of my mother's summer tables often. She launched meals, seemingly with ease. Finally, it dawns on me, maybe I'm not simply inadequate. It was easier then. She had people around her, as we do here. I sat on the ice cream churn while my sister turned the handle. My other sister shelled peas. Willie was totally capable. My mother directed kitchen traffic, arranged the table. Here I have that prime ingredient, time. Guests really do want to pit the cherries or run into town for another wedge of Parmigiano. Also, cooking seems to take less time because the quality of the food is so fine that only the simplest preparations are called for. Zucchini has a real taste. Charred, sautéed with a little garlic is amazing. Fruit does not come with stickers. Vegetables are not waxed or irradiated, and the taste is truly different. Nights turn cool at 1,500 feet. That suits us because we can prepare some of the hearty foods that are not at all suitable in the sun. While prosciutto with figs, chilled tomato soup, Roman artichokes, and pasta with lemon peel and asparagus are perfect at 1, the fresh evenings fuel the appetite. We serve spaghetti with ragu, minestrone with globes of pesto, ossobuco, grilled polenta, baked red peppers stuffed with ricotta and herb custard, warm cherries in Chianti with hazelnut pound cake. When tomatoes are ripe, nothing is better than cold tomato soup with a handful of basil and a garnish of polenta croutons. Panzanella, little swamp, is another tomato favorite, a salad of oil, vinegar, tomatoes, basil, cucumber, minced onion, and stale bread soaked in water and squeezed dry, a true invention from necessity. Since bread must be bought every day, Tuscan cooking makes good use of leftovers. The rough loaves work perfectly for bread puddings and for the best French toast I've ever had. We go for days without meat and don't even miss it. Then a roasted faraona, guinea hen with rosemary, or sage-stuffed pork loin remind us of how fabulous the plainest meats can be. I cut a small basket full of thyme, rosemary, and sage, wishing I could beam one of each plant to San Francisco, where I keep a window box of faltering herbs going. Here the sun doubles their size every few weeks. The oregano near the well quickly spreads to a circle around 3 feet wide. Even the wild mint and lemon balm I dug up on the hill and moved have taken off. Mint thrives. Virgil says deer wounded by hunters seek it for wounds. In Tuscany, where hunters long since have driven out most wildlife, the mint is more plentiful than deer. Maria Rita at the Frutta e Verdura tells me to use lemon balm in salads and vegetables, as well as in my bath water. I think I would like cutting herbs even if I weren't cooking. The pungency of just snipped herbs adds as much to the cook's enjoyment as to taste. After weeding the thyme, I don't wash my hands until the fragrance fades from them. I planted a hedge of sage more than I ever could use, and let most flower for the butterflies. Sage flowers, along with lavender, look pretty in wildflower bouquets. The rest I dry or use fresh, usually for white beans with chopped sage and olive oil, a favorite of Tuscans who are known as bean eaters. Anytime we grill, Ed tosses long wands of rosemary on the coals and on the meat. The crispy leaves not only add flavor, they're good to nibble, too. When he grills shrimp, he threads them on rosemary sticks. I have pots of basil by the kitchen door because it's supposed to keep out flies. During the wall building and well drilling weeks, I saw a worker crush leaves in his hand and smear his wasp sting. He said it took away all the pain. A larger patch grows a few feet away. The more I cut off, the more seems to grow. I use whole leaves in salad, bunches for pesto, copious amounts in sautéed summer squashes and tomato dishes. Of all herbs, basil holds the essence of Tuscan summer. The long stretch of summer lunches calls for long tavola. Now that the kitchen is finished, we need a table outdoors, the longer the better, because inevitably guests gather. Friends from home, a relative's friends from somewhere who thought they'd say hello since they were in the area, and new friends, sometimes with friends of theirs. Add another handful of pasta to the boiling pot. Add a plate, a tumbler, find another chair. The table in the kitchen can oblige. I have considered my table, its ideals as well as its dimensions. If I were a child, I would want to lift up the tablecloth and crawl under the unending table into the flaxen light, where I could crouch and listen to the loud laughs, clinks, and grown-up talk, hear over and over salute and chin-chin traveling around the chairs, stare at kneecaps and walking shoes and flowered skirts hiked up to catch a breeze, the table steady underneath its weight of food. Such a table should accommodate the wanderings of a large dog. At the end, you need room for an enormous vase of all the flowers in bloom at the moment. The width should allow platters to meander from hand to hand down the center, stopping where they will, and numerous wine and water bottles to accumulate over the hours. You need room for a bowl of cool water for dipping the grapes and pears, a little covered dish to keep the bugs off the gorgonzola. No one cares if olive pits are flung into the distance. The best wardrobe for such a table runs to blue checks, pink and green plaid, not dead white, which takes in too much glare. If the table is long enough, everything can be brought out at once, and no one has to run back and forth to the kitchen. Then the table is set for primary pleasure, lingering meals under the trees at noon. The open air confers an ease, a relaxation, and freedom. You're your own guest, which is the way summer ought to be. In the delicious stupor that sets in after the last pear is halved, the last crust scoops up the last crumbles of gorgonzola, and the last drop empties into the glass, you can ruminate, if you're inclined that way, on your participation in the great collective unconscious. You are doing what everyone else in Italy is doing, millions of backsides being shined by chairs at millions of tables. The rhythm of Tuscan dining may throw us off, but after a long lunch outside, one concept is clear, siesta. The logic of a three-hour fall through the crack of the day makes perfect sense. Best to pick up that Piero della Francesca book, wander upstairs, and give in to it. I know I want a wooden table. When I was growing up, my father had dinners for his men friends and a few employees on Fridays. Our cook, Willie Bell, and my mother spread a long white table under a pecan tree in our yard, with fried chicken cooked right there on our brick barbecue, potato salad, biscuits, iced tea, pound cake, and bottles of gin and southern comfort. The noon meal often lasted most of the day, sometimes ending with the swaying men arm in arm singing Darktown Strutter's Ball, and I'm a Ramblin' Wreck from Georgia Tech, slowly as if on a tape that warped in the sun. From the very first weeks we lived in the house, we used the abandoned work table, a crude prototype of the table I imagined us eventually setting under the line of 5 tiyi trees. At a market stall, I bought tablecloths, long to keep splinters from digging into our knees, with napkins to match, a jar of poppies, Queen Anne's lace and blue bachelor's buttons on the table, our yellow plates from the co-op, we served forth, mainly to each other. My idea of heaven is a 2-hour lunch with Ed. I believe he must have been Italian in another life. He has begun to gesture and wave his hands, which I've never seen him do. He likes to cook at home, but simply throws himself into it here. For a lunch he prepares, he gathers Parmigiano, fresh mozzarella, some pecorino from the mountains, red peppers, just-picked lettuces, the local salami with fennel, loaves of pane con sale, the bread that isn't strictly traditional here since it has salt, prosciutto, a glorious bag of tomatoes. For dessert, peaches, plums, and my favorite, a local watermelon called Mine di Monica, Nun's Tits. He piles the breadboard with our cheeses, salami, peppers, and on our plates arranges our first course, the classic caprese, sliced tomatoes, basil, mozzarella, and a drizzle of oil. In the tilia shade, we're protected from the midday heat, the cicadas yammer in the trees, that deeply heart of summer sound. The tomatoes are so intense we go silent as we taste them. Ed opens a celebratory bottle of Prosecco, and we settle down to recap the saga of buying and restoring the house. Oddly, we now omit the complications and panic. We've begun the selection process, the same one that ensures the continuance of the human race, forgetting the labor. Ed starts drawing up plans for a bread oven. We dream on about other projects. The sun through the flowering trees bathes us in gold-sifted light. This isn't real. We've wandered into a Fellini film, I say. Ed shakes his head. Fellini is a documentary filmmaker. I've lost my belief in his genius. There are Fellini scenes everywhere. Remember the brilliant motorcycle that comes around and around in Amarcord? It happens all the time. You're nowhere in a remote village, no one in sight, and suddenly a huge Moto Guzzi streaks by. He peels a peach in one long spiral, and just because this was all too pleasant, we open a second bottle of Prosecco and while away another hour before we drift in to rest and revive our energy for a walk into town to case out the restaurants, stroll along the parterre overlooking the valley, and, hard to contemplate, begin the next meal. We have called the shy and silent carpenters Marco and Rudolfo. They seem amused no matter what work they do here. The idea of a painted table seating 10 seems to stun them. They're used to chestnut stain. Are we certain? I see them swap a glance with each other. But it will have to be repainted in 2 years. Too impractical. We've sketched what we want and have the paint sample, too, primary yellow. They return 4 days later with the table sealed and painted. They laugh and say it will glow in the dark. It does pulsate with color. They haul it to the spot with the broadest view into the valley. In the deep shade, the yellow shines, luring us to come forth from the house with jugs and steaming bowls, baskets of fruit and fresh cheeses wrapped in grape leaves. Dinner tonight is for an Italian couple, their baby, and our compatriot writers. This Italian baby girl at 7 months chews on piquant olives and looks longingly at the food. Our friends have been amused by our adventures in restoration, safely amused since their houses were restored before workmen disappeared and before the dollar dove. Each knows an astonishing amount about wells, septic systems, gutters, pruning, minute technical knowledge acquired by years under the roofs of quirky old farmhouses. We're awed by their fluency with Italian, their endless knowledge of the intricacies of telephone bills. Though I imagine conversations about the currents in Italian literature, opera, and controversial restorations, we seem to discuss most passionately olive pruning, grease traps, well testing, and shutter repair. The menu? With drinks, bruschetta with chopped tomatoes and basil, crostini with red pepper confit. The first course, gnocchi, not the usual potato, but light semolina gnocchi. Small servings, it's rich. Followed by veal roasted with garlic and potatoes, then garnished with fried sage. The little green beans still crisp, warm with fennel and olives. Just before the guests arrive, I pick a huge basket of lettuces. At the start of summer, I scatter two envelopes of mixed lettuces as an edging along a flower bed. They were up in a week and in three bolted the border. Now they're everywhere. It feels odd to be weeding the flower bed and accumulating dinner at the same time. Some look unfamiliar. I hope we're not eating just sprouting calendula or hollyhocks. The cherries, simmered and cool, have attracted bees to them all afternoon. One of the tiny hummingbirds made a quick foray into the kitchen, drawn possibly by the scent of the deep red wine syrup. When the guests arrive, it will be the slow, soft Tuscan twilight, fading after drinks, from transparent to golden to evening blue, then, by the end of the first course, into night. Night happens quickly, as though the sun were pulled in one motion under the hill. We light candles in hurricane shades along the wall and on the table. For background music, a hilarious chorus of frogs tunes up. Molti anni fa, many years ago, our friends begin. Their stories weave in Italy around us that we only know through books and films. In the 60s, in the 70s, a true paradise. That's why they came and stayed. Then the talk shifts to politics. They know everyone. We're all horrified at the car bombing in Sicily. Is there a mafia here? Our questions are naive. The fascist leaning in recent elections disturbs everyone. Could Italy go back? I feel immersed here. My so-called real life seems remote. Odd that we're all here. We were given one country and we've set ourselves up in another. I almost feel our strange voices, English, French, Italian, spreading out around the house, over the valley. Sound carries on the hills. Stranieri, foreigners, we're called, but it sounds more dire, more like strangers, an oddly chilling word. Often we hear the parties of invisible neighbors above us. We've shifted an ancient order of things on this hillside where the tax collector, the police captain, and the newsstand owner, our nearest neighbors, although we can't see any of them, heard only Italian until we encamped here. The Big Dipper, clear as a dot-to-dot drawing, seems about to pour something right on top of the house, and the Milky Way sweeps its bridal train of scattered stars over our heads. The frogs go silent all at once, as if someone shushed them. Ed brings out the Vinsanto and a plate of biscotti he made this morning. Now the night is big and quiet, no moon. We talk, talk, talk. Nothing to interrupt us except the shooting stars. Cortona, noble city. Cortona merits almost 7 pages in the excellent Blue Guide, Northern Italy. The writer meticulously directs the walker up each street, pointing out what's of interest. Each side altar in the cathedral is described according to its cardinal orientation, so that if you happen to know which way east is, after traveling the winding roads, you can locate yourself and self-guide through the nooks and crannies. The writers even identified all the murky paintings in the choir area. Reading the guide, I'm overwhelmed once again by all the art, architecture, history in one little hill town. This is only one of hundreds of such former marauder lookouts, perched picturesquely for views now. Now that I know this one place a little, I read with doubled perception. The guide directs me to the acacia-shaded lane along the inside wall of the town, and I immediately remember the modest stone houses on one side, the view over the Val di Chiana on the other. I see, too, the three-legged dog I know lives in the house that always has the enormous underpants drying on a line. I see the cane-bottom chairs all the people who live along that glorious stretch of wall pull out at evening when they view the sunset and check in with the stars. Yesterday, walking there, I almost stepped on a still soft dead rat. Inside one of the doorways that opens right out onto the narrow street, I glimpsed a woman holding her head in her hands at the kitchen table. Whether she was weeping or catching a catnap, I don't know. People travel for as many reasons as they don't travel. I'm so glad I went to London, a friend told me in college. Now I don't ever have to go again. The opposite end of that spectrum is my friend Charlotte, who crossed China in the back of a truck, an alternate route into Tibet. In his poem, Words from a Totem Animal, W.S. Merwin cuts to the core. Send me out into another life, Lord, because this one is growing faint. I do not think it goes all the way. Once in a place, that journey to the far interior of the psyche begins or it doesn't. Something must make it yours, that ineffable something no book can capture. It can be so simple, like the light I saw on the faces of the three women walking with their arms linked when the late afternoon sun slanted into the Rugapiana. That light seemed to fall like a benison on everyone beneath it. I, too, wanted to soak my skin under such a sun. The ideal approach to my new hometown is first to see the Etruscan tombs down in the flatland below the town. There are tombs from 800 to 200 B.C. near the train station in Camuchia and on the road to Foiano, where the custodian never likes the tip. Maybe he's in a bad mood because he spends eerie nights. His small farmhouse with a bean patch and yard-roaming chickens coexist with this tomba that would appear strangely primordial in the moonlight. A little uphill, a rusted yellow sign is all that points to the so-called tomb of Pythagoras. I pull over and walk along a stream until I reach a short lane, cypress-lined, leading to the tomb. There's a gate, but it doesn't look as if anyone ever bothers to close it. So there it is, just sitting on a round stone platform. Niches for the upright sarcophagi look like the shrine at the bottom of my driveway. The ceiling is partly gone, but enough of the curve is left that I can see the dome shape. I'm standing inside a structure someone put together at least 2,000 years ago. One massive stone over the door is a perfect half moon. The mysterious Etruscans. My knowledge of them until I started to come to Italy was limited to the fact that they preceded the Romans and that their language was indecipherable. Since they built with wood, little remained. I was almost all wrong. Not much of their written language has been found, but much has been translated by now, thanks to the crucial find of some strips of linen shroud from an Egyptian mummy that traveled to Zagreb as a curio and were preserved later in a museum there. How the Etruscan linen, inscribed with texts in ink made from soot or coal, became the wrapping for a young girl is still unknown. Possibly, Etruscans migrated to Egypt after they were conquered by Rome around the 1st century B.C., and the girl was actually Etruscan. Or perhaps the linen was simply a convenient remnant torn into strips by embalmers who used whatever was at hand. The mummy carried enough Etruscan text to provide several key routes, although the language still isn't totally translated. It's too bad what they left written on stone is gravestone information and government fact. A friend told me that last year a local geometer discovered a bronze tablet covered with Etruscan writing. He kicked it up in the dirt of a farmhouse where he was overseeing a renovation and took it home. The police heard about this and called on him that night. Presumably, it is in the hands of archaeologists. Of the local Etruscan culture, an astonishing amount continues to be unearthed. Beside one of the local tombs, a seven-step stairway of stone flanked with reclining lions intertwined with human parts, probably a nightmare vision of the underworld, was discovered in 1990. Nearby Chiusi, like Cortona, one of the original 12 cities of Etruria, only recently found its town walls. Both Cortona and Chiusi have extensive collections of Etruscan artifacts found both by archaeological digs and by farmers turning up bronze figures in their furrows.